You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
After Nelson Mandela died last December, South African novelist J.M. Coetzee wrote, "He may well be the last of the great men as the concept of greatness retires into the historical shadows." From his 20 years, Zelda LaGrange worked as a private secretary for Mr. Mandela, who would have turned 96 last Friday. Remarkably, she came to that job after growing up in a conservative white Africana home. Ms. LaGrange tells the story of her years of working with South Africa's first black chief executive in Good Morning, Mr. Mandela, a memoir. Viking is publishing it, and I'm very pleased that it brings Zelda LaGrange to our show today. Hello.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Leonard.
What was Nelson Mandela like personally, out of the public eye?
You know, a kind human being, a very sincere type of person, friendly, great sense of humor.
You would think that after the way he had been treated and how many years of his life he had lost, that there would be a certain bitterness. No bitterness?
No. You know, in 19 years that I've worked for him, there was not really one day that I could detect any kind of bitterness.
You first started working for him in 1994, and he was in his mid-70s at the time. He had spent 27 years in prison. Was he energetic still?
Yes, very energetic. I think if you compare the age, I was 24 years of age when I started working for him. He was in his 70s. He had triple the amount of energy that I had. I think he was driven in a way also to catch up. You know, there was various factors, but he wanted to catch up, make up for lost time. And he was determined to bring about change in South Africa.
Given your Afrikaner background, how did you land a job working for him?
Well, it was just purely because of logistical reasons that I applied for this job in the presidency. It was just because it was closer to my parents' home where I lived at the time. And I was lucky to be the successful candidate in his private secretary's office at the time.
Many Americans might hear Afrikaner and think privileged. Was your family privileged or wealthy?
No, not necessarily, no.
But every white person was privileged during apartheid.
Yes, you are born to privilege in South Africa, or you were born if you were white. We had access to basic services, good education and so on, but we weren't rich or wealthy. We were very ordinary, you know, a middle-class kind of family.
What did your family think when you told them that you would be working for Mandela?
Well, at first, my father, I think he thought I exaggerated. He didn't really think I would ever really see Nelson Mandela. And my mother, you know, she's a kind of person. She's a very softly spoken person, and she was impressed, and it didn't really bother her. I don't think they ever imagined this to be as big as it then later became.
But since they had been opposed to him, were they at all disturbed that you were working for him?
No, I think because of what I said to you earlier, I don't think they ever thought that I would be so close to him. They thought it was just in a back office. I would never really see the president. So I don't think they ever imagined that we would become close.
Did they ever get to meet him?
Yes, they did on a few occasions. And right till the end, when Mr. Mandela conversed with me, he would always ask me, how's your parents? How's your father?
Do you think most white South Africans who are opposed to freeing him from prison have changed their opinion by now?
Most people, yes, but there's still pockets of racism, as we call it in South Africa. Still people, you know, that still today oppose the free society and democracy.
And many white South Africans have left the country.
Yes, they have many. You know, we've had a lot of skill. We've lost a lot of skill in South Africa. But you know what? people need to go where they are comfortable. If they're not comfortable building a new South Africa, then you know it's what it is.
Hadn't your father denounced Mandela as a terrorist? What did your family think when he was freed in 1990 after he'd been in prison for 27 years?
Well, my father thought we were in trouble. You know, it was really a threat to white superiority. We thought that, you know, the black people were going to take revenge on white South Africans. And Nelson Mandela represented that fear to us.
You eventually became private secretary to the office of the president. What kind of work did that involve?
Well, anything and everything, really. You know, it was a combination between public relations and protocol and foreign affairs, and it was really a combination of all kinds of jobs, including administrative tasks, of course.
Were you working for him until his death last December?
Yes, I was. Even though the job changed over years, and the last 2 years, it was more on a consultant basis. I worked for him. I was still employed as his private secretary.
Well, he was in seriously declining health in the last couple of years. Did he try to remain active despite that?
Not over the last 3 or 4 years, I would say. You know, he was no longer active. We had to make sure that he didn't become isolated or that he felt isolated. So we had to bring friends and so on for him to spend time with his peers and his people still.
You would think that after all those years in prison and so many demands on him after his release that he would just like to relax and take time for himself after he retired.
Yes, he did. And the last couple of years, he did have time to do that. But also, you know, there's a fine balance, and you had to make sure that he didn't feel isolated and that he still remained in contact with his friends and his colleagues, prisoners that spent so much time with him.
My guest is Zelda LaGrange. She has written Good Morning, Mr. Mandela, a memoir. You and others refer to him as Madiba. Does that have a special meaning, like the Sanskrit word that's used for Gandhi, Mahatma, meaning great soul?
It is Madiba is simply a clan name. There's about 1,000 people in South Africa that's part of the Madiba clan. So it's really just a clan name, but it's also been used in an endearing way referring to him.
Do you see any link between the fact that Gandhi got his start in South Africa?
Yes, I do think, you know, the African soil has been able to produce these wonderful people in our history. I think it's the simplicity almost of the country, of the land, you know, that produces this greatness.
You describe yourself as Mandela's honorary granddaughter, and you seem to suggest that you and Mandela may have shared a need for loyalty or a fear of abandonment. Can you explain that?
Yes, well, I don't describe myself as his honorary granddaughter. He described me as that. It's not something that I easily accept. But yes, there was a codependency. You know, I depended on him emotionally. At that stage of my life, I was going through a lot of emotional changes and so on. So I became emotionally dependent on him. He needed that loyalty, commitment, 100% dedication. So he recognized that in me, and that worked well together.
When you were growing up in the 1970s, how aware were you of the political turmoil in South Africa?
Nothing whatsoever. You know, in South Africa in the apartheid years, you really grew up not knowing what the outside world was all about. So we were completely oblivious of the political situation in South Africa.
In an interview you gave in 2008, you said, "The one thing we knew was that it was always a question of black against white in South Africa. That had been dictated to us by the church and the schools and the system and the history we were taught." So has that history been changed at all?
Yes. The modern history now reflects the true history of South Africa, you know, and the struggles that black South Africans went through.
White South Africans voted on abolishing apartheid in 1992 when you were 22 years old. And you write that you voted against abolition.
Yes, because it was a threat to my security. I thought black people were going to take revenge on us, you know, so to almost protect my environment, I voted against the abolishment of apartheid.
But did you really think that apartheid could stay in place?
No.
F.W. de Klerk, the last African president of South Africa, he obviously was like Gorbachev in realizing that the status quo was no longer tenable.
At that time, when I drew that cross on that ballot paper, I didn't think, I thought that apartheid could still stand. I didn't know the pressure from the outside world. I didn't know what was happening in the rest of the world. Now, looking back, there was no way that apartheid could stand.
Did you tell Mandela how you had voted?
Yes, I did. And he found it very amusing and funny, actually. And he teased me about it for years.
What changes did you see after apartheid was legally ended? Was it all positive? Because South Africa is still a troubled country.
Yes, not all positive. I mean, you know, we've got great prospects in South Africa. People are generally optimistic about the future of South Africa, but poverty is still our biggest challenge. The lack of proper education for our children is still our biggest problem, and we haven't economically transformed as a country as we would have wished to by now.
Everybody assumed that it would become much more egalitarian than it has. There would be more equality between the races.
Yes, but I think
there's still a lot of unemployment.
Absolutely, yes, and I think it's. But I think that's a worldwide phenomenon right now. We are not managing, you know, to address poverty properly.
South Africa has a serious HIV/AIDS problem.
Yes, well, our figures are looking better, much better than he did it, 5 or 10 years ago.
Because of government policy
because
changes.
Because of government policy and now people having access to ARVs. So it is, the figures are telling us that they're making progress.
In your earliest days working in the president's office, you fielded phone calls. And your office got a call from a serial killer?
Yes. he was on the run. And for some reason, people trusted Mr. Mandela. People felt that they could confide in him. They felt safe to hand themselves over. Even a serial killer wanted to hand himself over to the president and to the president only. So, our office received that call and we managed to hand it over to the police and they could arrest him in time before he escaped again.
Had you met Mandela by that time?
Yes, by then I was growing familiar.
With so many people from around the world seeking his time, should I assume that sometimes you felt like you were at your wit's end?
Yes, now more than once. yes, it was very difficult to absorb the kind of pressure from the outside world. Very difficult.
And then it must have been a bit intimidating for you, coming from a modest background, suddenly finding yourself in situations where you're meeting heads of state. You describe what must have been a state dinner with Queen Noor of Jordan. It sounds like it was rather nerve-wracking.
It was nerve-wracking. And coming from such an ordinary background, the girl next door, as I've been described, to land yourself to be in that kind of situation where you're suddenly sitting next to a queen of a country, it's not for everyone. So I had, I had to go through quite a bit of growing up. But Mr. Mandela was just the greatest teacher, and he mentored me, and he held my hand throughout this process. And that was really, what helped me through all of this.
Although he could be a bit undiplomatic.
Yes,
did you actually see him greet Queen Elizabeth with, "Oh, Elizabeth, you've lost weight"?
Yes. I personally witnessed that, and it was very funny to watch because the Queen she wasn't offended in any way. She was almost charmed in a way by his compliment.
Over the years, you must have met an enormous number of heads of state and international figures. Any really stand out?
Yes, obviously, because we've been very close to them, and they were in office in the same over the same period of time. The Clintons, we are very close to President Clinton and his family.
Some of the people who were part of this history have won Nobel Prizes, not just Nelson Mandela, also Nadine Gordimer, who just passed away.
Mm.
And F.W. de Klerk, yes. The man who freed Mandela from prison, although he probably, some people might argue that he probably didn't deserve the Nobel.
Well, for someone, for a president to surrender power because you, not only because your back is against the wall, but also because you realize this is the right thing for history, this is the right thing to do. It took a lot of guts from Mr. de Klerk to do that. And he should be complimented for that, he should be held for that. And Mr. Mandela always said that, he had a lot of respect for Mr. de Klerk because he took that decision, which was obviously the right decision at the time.
Zelda LaGrange has written a memoir called Good Morning, Mr. Mandela. It is published by Viking, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Zelda LaGrange, her memoir, Good Morning, Mr. Mandela, published by Viking. It sounds like he promised you to bring to be his private secretary and specialist in Afrikaans on the spur of the moment.
Yes, it was never something that I don't know whether he ever sat and thought about this, but it's definitely not something I had to consider. The honor and the privilege to be chosen by Nelson Mandela to serve him, you don't need to think about that.
As president, he was in a position to deal with the white South Africans who had sustained apartheid. What sense did you get of how he wanted to deal with them?
Well, I saw him waking up every single morning wanting to reconcile South Africa, wanting to unify the country. We came from we were a very bruised society, and he wanted to bring about healing, and his choices and his decisions always reflected that.
Was he behind the idea to create the Truth and Reconciliation hearings in 1996?
Yes, that was his brainchild.
Some, including the family of Steve Biko, criticized the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and Mandela for being too lenient and with rights abusers. Did you get a sense of what he felt about that?
Well, you know what, he established the commission and he wanted them to be independent in their dealings. He tried in the background, as I write in the book, he tried, to negotiate with people like the former president, P.W. Botha and so on, unsuccessfully. But he tried. I don't think he would ever look back and be completely satisfied with everything. But I think the fact that there was these attempts, you know, that speaks for itself. It's worth more than the failure. Yes.
Some countries had been very accommodating towards South Africa during the decades of apartheid. President Reagan advocated what he called constructive engagement. Did you ever get any impression of what Mandela thought of foreign leaders like Ronald Reagan or Margaret Thatcher, who were not willing to even try to impose sanctions?
Well, he was very outspoken, as you know. As a leader, Mr. Mandela would criticize people in public, but that never influenced the relationship going forward. It was always a respectful relationship, although he differed in opinion from them, and he made that clear to someone like Margaret Thatcher. Although he didn't agree with her and her stance, and he criticized her, they were able to have a cup of tea on a few occasions after his presidency even.
Did he have a good relationship with Bishop Desmond Tutu, who had declared Reagan policy as immoral, evil, and totally unchristian?
He had a very good relationship with the Arch, yes. The Arch was very close to us, he still is, yes.
Do you know when Mandela arrived at the idea of reconciliation? In the early 1960s, he'd gone to prison under South Africa's terrorism laws, and he had defended the use of violent resistance at that time.
Yes, well, the important word is resistance. You know, it was a way of responding to what the government was doing about apartheid. They were on the attack, and violence was therefore becoming the only means of fighting apartheid in response to how the government wanted to deal with it. But the reconciliation, you know, what I've asked him on many occasions, and it was a decision for him to choose freedom. It's a decision to forgive.
There were a number of white South Africans who supported democracy: Helen Joseph, Alan Paton, Nadine Gordimer, Andre Brink, and others. Did Mandela ever consult with them about the transition out of apartheid?
All the time. I mean, he had a very close relationship with Helen Suzman. And,
who had been the only white opponent to apartheid for many years.
That's right. But that was also part of the inclusivity of Nelson Mandela. He always negotiated. He always got the opinions of everyone around him. He got a 360 degrees opinion poll almost before he took any decision.
Had you heard about these people, Helen Sussman or Nadine Gordimer, Andre Brink?
Not before 1994, no, sadly not.
They weren't in the newspapers?
Yes, they were, but at that age, you know, at the age of 21 in South Africa, it was very uncommon to read newspapers for the youth.
Nelson Mandela retired from the presidency in 1999. One presidential term is 5 years. Did he consider running for a second term?
No, he made it clear right from the beginning that he was too old and he wanted to hand over the baton to younger people, a younger generation.
One of the shocking things in reading your book is learning just how he was treated after he retired.
Yes, it was not always, in my opinion, as I say to people, you know, this book is really my opinion, my experiences, but in my opinion, he wasn't treated with the respect that he deserved.
Why do you think that was? Were they consulting with him?
No, not really.
Was he treated as an advisor?
I don't think history has given us, you know, a blueprint to deal with someone like Nelson Mandela. So I think they were caught off guard, really. How do you deal with this the statesman, this icon in the world? How do you provide for them? How do you lay out a path from the ANC side? What is it that you want him to achieve? I don't think they were clear themselves on that, so it created some problems.
Were they afraid of being compared to him because he was presented as something of a saint, and absolutely. It sounds like he almost
absolutely.
Was.
Absolutely. I mean, how would you follow in that footsteps, you know? So you can't also just criticize them blindly, but how do you actually fulfill those shoes?
On the other hand, it must have been a bit embarrassing when people learned that President Thabo Mbeki refused to take Mandela's calls.
Yes, as I write in the book, we don't know if it was really him or just his staff. You know, your staff can cause you a considerable amount of damage. So I don't know who it was, but we had problems getting through to him at some point.
President Jacob Zuma set up a photo opportunity when you and Mandela's wife, Graca Machel, were away. Were they taking advantage of him?
Yes, that's how I felt. That's how I experienced it. Yes, there was no need to photograph him then. There was no need to parade him, really. And people with cameras were allowed in the house without us knowing about it. So yes, that's how I felt.
Was he still as sharp as he had been earlier?
No. He was quite elderly, and the deterioration had already advanced at that stage. So it was a difficult day for him specifically as well. It was not the right thing.
On the treatment of Mandela's wife, his third wife, Graca Machel, at the time of his memorial service, you write, "I don't know of any person alive who has been treated with the amount of disrespect that people have shown toward Mrs. Machel." Mm. How was she treated and why?
She was never consulted. I mean, she's burying her husband, you know, and her requests and the things she wanted for her husband, she was excluded almost from the whole process.
Because she was a foreigner?
No, not really, because I think she was, she was the third wife. I don't know. I can't speak on other people's behalf on this, you know, but it was very painful to watch.
Could it have been out of loyalty to Winnie Mandela? Because Winnie had gone through a rather troubled history before this.
It could be, but you know what? If you deal with a person as complex as Nelson Mandela, you can expect this kind of complexity around his funeral. So although we were caught off guard, we were not really surprised. This is to be expected.
How were you treated as Mandela declined?
Well, I was excluded, you know, from knowing what was going on. I didn't really know, how health-wise, medically, how he was doing. And then as you read in the book, probably, I wasn't allowed to pay tribute at his gravesite. I wasn't there when he was buried. But you know what? It's all things of the past now. You deal with these things.
Who didn't want you there? The family?
Yeah, probably some of the family. I don't know, really. We still don't know who was in charge, but I can just assume it's the family, some of the family. And it's also incorrect to say the entire family, but some of the family, yes.
My guest is Zelda LaGrange. She's written a memoir called Good Morning, Mr. Mandela. It is published by Viking. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. I guess the title comes from the fact that every morning you'd say that to him as he came into the office?
No, not really. You know what, Leonard? It was the day that I met him for the first time, when I shook his hand, that I realized, but the way I was brought up and what I was brought up to believe, that this man is the terrorist, this man is the enemy of my people. Yet he extended the hand to me. He smiled. He was so sincere. He was kind. There was kindness in his eyes. That day, my entire being, my entire life changed. So by greeting him, saying, "Good morning, Mr. Mandela," it was just a life-changing experience.
Getting back to the family, how large a family did Mandela have? I'm guessing they didn't all get along.
No. Even in my own family, we are a small family. We don't all get along, but it's about 40, you're looking at 40, 50 people. That's the extended family.
That's a big family.
It's a huge family.
Many Americans have heard of the allegations of murder and other crimes against Winnie Mandela. What effect did those allegations have on Nelson Mandela?
Well, it's not really something, you know, I ever discussed with him. It's not part of the territory that I moved in. You know, I was really working with his public life, not with his private life as much. So I didn't really discuss it with him.
He launched a charitable foundation called 466. 46664.
That's right.
He did that after he retired. Mm. What was the meaning of that name?
It is his prison number. He was prisoner number 466, and he was sentenced to life imprisonment in 1964. So that's where 46664 comes from.
Didn't you work for the foundation?
Yes, I still do. I'm still a part-time employee of the foundation.
A lot of foundation work involves fundraising. Was Mandela a natural fundraiser in the way that Bill Clinton has proven to be?
Yes, I don't think he was as successful as President Clinton, but he was a natural fundraiser. It was easy for him to ask for money, especially if it was for a good cause.
But you describe a South African diplomat sabotaging his charitable fundraising. What happened?
Yes, yeah, some weird interference in the Middle East when we asked for a donation and it was agreed upon. And this diplomat, I don't know what he actually did, but he interfered and diverted the money or the donation elsewhere. And subsequently, we left with empty-handed.
Mandela must have been very upset by the corruption that followed him, after he left office.
Well, the corruption has really only been very present in the last few years. And luckily, Mr. Mandela's aging process, in a way, shielded him from knowing exactly what was going on. He was really very, very, very old, and aging very fast over the last couple of years. So he wasn't always aware of things happening. And also Mrs. Machel protected him by keeping some of the newspapers away from him.
Does the press hound political figures in South Africa the way they do in Europe and the United States?
Oh, yes, they do. Not successfully enough, in my opinion, but they do, yes.
Given his legacy in the democracy movement, have people been concerned about how South Africa will manage now that he is totally out of the picture?
Yes, I think we also find that very visible right now in South Africa. There's a huge racial debate going on and whether reconciliation was really the right thing to do at the time, because economically we haven't made the progress we wanted to, and now people are feeling that and people are angry.
What has held back that economic progress?
A number of things, the land reform issue is a huge stumble block still.
It hasn't worked well in Zimbabwe.
No.
It didn't work well in Uganda.
No, we don't have great examples, do we? So that's a very a current issue right now for us. But also, it's South Africa, we are still a bruised society, and I don't think we've dealt with the after effect of apartheid psychologically. So we still grapple with those issues, and it's difficult therefore to make economic progress if mentally things are not stable almost in a way in South Africa yet.
In this country, we talk a lot about inequality and the 99%, the 1%, but South Africa has even greater inequality than the United States.
Well, percentage-wise, I'd like to differ. Yes, well, we do, but I think there's been progress. We shouldn't forget that coming out of apartheid, there were a lot of challenges for us to deal with, rectifying the injustices of the past. Few people in South Africa knew that pension money was actually used to keep apartheid alive, to fight to defend apartheid. So the pension money had to be replenished before we could move forward, and it's only once the ANC government came into power that they really realized that. So it is, to rectify those injustices. It was never going to be easy. It can't be a 5-year period. I think you're looking at another 10 years before we'll probably only start seeing the real progress.
But South Africa is a country that is rich in natural resources, and gold and diamonds continue to be mined, maybe not always under the best of circumstances, but it has great agriculture. Why is it having so many problems?
Because I think that's an answer with two parts. First of all, you have individuals who are still greedy. You still have individuals who are the only people that are really benefiting from the resources. That's where we haven't made enough progress as far as transformation is concerned. And then you've got corruption. That's the two issues that's really preventing us from transforming that economy fast enough.
One of the political hot button issues right now in the United States is illegal immigration. About 5 million of South Africa's 50 million people are not there legally, including about 3 million from Zimbabwe. Is that a political issue in South Africa?
Yes, it is a huge political issue. We've had incidences of xenophobia not long ago. So it's a pressing issue, and a lot of people feel that we've got a lot of immigrants in South Africa relying on our economy while we struggle ourselves, you know, to make progress.
Considering some of the stories that you include in this book, has your book generated any controversy in South Africa?
Oh, yes, a lot. After the first serialization, people thought this was a tell-all book, you know, and they thought it's a book about Nelson Mandela. The fact is, this is not a definitive book about Nelson Mandela. This is the human story. I had an obligation sharing 19 years of my life with him, sharing that person with the rest of the world. Once people read the book, you know, they come back and they say, I'm sorry, you know, I thought it was a tell-all, but it's actually a beautiful human story.
But you do tell a lot.
I do.
Sometimes,
but most of it has been
that's
in the
bad
public.
About the government.
Yes, no, absolutely, because I had to be honest, you know. And you can't choose to be honest just on one topic. You have to be honest about everything.
How has the Mandela family responded to the book?
Well, again, you know, the family, it's a huge family. It's 50 people. You're not even going to keep your own family happy with the entire book. So I never expected to you know, please everyone. Some of them are happy and some of them are not.
You are now a full-time employee of the Nelson Mandela Foundation?
Part-time employee.
And a writer?
No. This is a once-off. I'm definitely not going to do this again.
Good morning, Mr. Mandela. Is Zelda LaGrange's memoir published by Viking. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks for having me. It was a nice chat. Thanks, Lynette.